Look,
we got some hot pants broad cruising around for some action. The guy she picked up went down on her in a cab.
After she finishes with him, she comes onto some weirdo in the elevator. Hey, there's all kinds of ways to get killed in this city, if you're looking for it.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus review of Dressed to Kill.
Don't make me be a bad girl again.
A review chosen by Now Playing patron Sean Ray.
I hope you're not going to keep me waiting.
Hosted by Jacob.
I moaned with pleasure at his touch.
Arnie.
What's the matter, huh? I'm a little crude for you, huh?
And Stuart.
All the time he's talking, I can see the bulge in his pants.
This podcast is spoiler-filled and contains harsh language.
We got a brutally murdered woman here who passed the point of being embarrassed by anything you might tell me.
Listener discretion is advised.
You want me to get in trouble, don't you?
You are in trouble.
We hope you enjoy the show.
I'm gonna go powder my nose. When I come back, I hope to find your clothes right next to mine.
Today we are Dressed to Kill, starring Michael Caine, Angie Dickinson, Nancy Allen, directed by Brian De Palma. This is the Now Playing co-host who's done most of the bad things you've just read about, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And you're talking to an expert on bad. This is Jacob.
And welcome back, patrons, for another De Palma movie. And this one was picked by a patron. Sean Ray is back with us. Sean, of all the De Palma films, why Dressed to Kill?
Well, you know, De Palma really has two sides to him. You know, he has the commercial films, some of which you guys have already covered. You know, Carrie, Scarface, Mission Impossible, The Untouchables, that kind of stuff. And then he has, like, you know, his smaller budget, more personal films, these Hitchcockian homages or ripoffs, depending on if you're a fan or not. And, you know, looking at the films you've covered, you know, this is probably the last remaining good example of what is a Brian De Palma film. This has all of his hallmarks, both positive and negative, I think.
And you're a big Brian De Palma fan. I remember this has come up in the past. I historically have been like, he's the ripoff guy. And you've been the guy to say, no, he's great. And I think you did a retrospective of all his work, right? Didn't you recently go through all his filmography?
Yes, I did. I couldn't finish everything. I did all the thrillers, and yeah, a lot of them seemed a little bit like Hitchcock ripoffs. And the thing that really got me just doing the research with this one is, you know, he really wanted to make Cruising and couldn't get the rights. So, you know, this was the makeup film. And here's something that might be kind of surprising or infuriating, depending on how you feel about the script of this film. But this screenplay sold for $1 million.
He wrote it. This is his work, yes. $1 million.
I gotta ask you, Stuart, because, you know, a lot of times we'll call out a film, oh, it's just copying this, it's copying that. You say that's postmodernism, like, that's the world we live in. Everyone's ripping off everyone, every story's been told. Why do you give De Palma such a hard... You're like, you're always quick to call him out, this Hitchcock ripoff. Isn't that just what happens in this modern age?
Yeah, it's a very valid question, and you're right. I hold Brian De Palma to a different standard than I do Quentin Tarantino, who is a huge fan.
Who I get harsh on him, yeah.
Yeah, but, like, is in the mold of. Is a disciple of Brian De Palma, is trying to do the same trick of pulling from the old to say something new. Yes, I agree. Anytime I'm coming back to Brian De Palma, I just want to point out, I keep saying I'm not a fan of the guy, and I keep really recommending his movies.
Yes, you do.
Every one we've covered, from Carrie, Blowout is in the book, Scarface, Untouchables, and the first Mission Impossible, all recommends from me. So what is my beef? I agree. What is my problem? I can tell you this much. I didn't really watch Brian De Palma growing up. I remember this movie was always on cable, and like the poster, I remember the legs and all of that. I remember wanting to see it in my horror movie phase, but I didn't see it until my first year of film school. I went into class and we had a visiting professor from Brazil who had a very thick accent, and he was always talking about this movie, Dressed to Kill, which I thought he was just speaking something in a foreign language. I did not know he was saying Dressed to Kill. So I was like, wow, this Dressed to Kill sounds like one of the best movies I've ever seen. And then, like, at the end, like, someone's like, no, it's Dressed to Kill. So I went out, I rented the movie, and then, like, he was gone, and I never got to ask him, what the fuck? What are you talking about? This was the movie you talked about all semester? Dressed to Kill? The best movie? But, yeah, it just surprised me, because I think at that point in time, one is very aware of film and the history of film. At that point, I had seen Psycho, I was studying Hitchcock. I think... Here's the knock on Brian De Palma. He was making these movies at a time when we didn't have VHS, people didn't have personal libraries, and revivals, not a lot of people would go back and watch Psycho, unless it maybe was airing on TV and just happened to catch it. So it felt like a 20-year-old movie was being plagiarized, and that mass audiences had no idea that this guy just part and parcel took this old movie and repackaged it with a sleazy bow. That's what it felt like. At the time, that was my indignation. Now, of course, time has passed, and as you say, I've had the luxury on Now Playing to watch lots of people remake lots of classic movies in their own image. And yes, that was my curiosity coming back to Dressed to Kill after all of these years, was did I find any connection to what that professor was talking about? Will I be able to see it in a more forgiving way? That was my hope. It's been going well so far with De Palma, but I haven't seen this movie in 25 years.
I just wanted to say, Stuart, you know, I could kind of agree with you on it, because for me, like, the scripting and what he has his, you know, the character motivations and what he has these people say is sometimes downright bad. But, you know, there's this whole other side. I think the technical aspects that he does, the camera work, the sound design, all that stuff, I feel like, wow, he's a master filmmaker, but you're not going to get me to defend the script or the acting.
And I do feel like a little bit of a hypocrite, because I know De Palma before I know Hitchcock, and I feel like a lot of times when we're reviewing a remake, screw that new shiny thing. Go watch the original. It's always going to be better. Like, I feel like that's my opinion. But in my own private life, like, what do I practice? No, I watch De Palma because I find his camera tricks and sound design and all that stuff really innovating and neat. And then, yeah, every once in a while, I go back to a Hitchcock thing. I'm like, oh, okay, he did get it from this. So I've seen this one before. I didn't pick up on all the Hitchcock stuff because that's just not something on my mind. But because you're always complaining about De Palma, Hitchcock ripoff, like, that was totally on my mind during this viewing this time.
You know what someone said to me that really made me want to see this movie again? They were like, I can't remember, someone wrote to me and they were like, you like giallos, what's the difference between this and Deep Red?
Yeah, that is true. This is very giallo.
Yeah, it is an American giallo film. It takes the high class, like, Hitchcock ideals and puts it in fishnets and says you're walking the streets and you're acting slutty. Like, this is a really smutty Hitchcock movie, and I should like that. A lot of people have taken from Hitchcock: Spielberg, Polanski, Fincher, Coppola. Like, get over it. What is Brian De Palma doing as how I'm approaching this movie coming back?
And I'm a newbie to this movie. If you asked me about Dressed to Kill, I would immediately think of Kiss's album where they first premiered Rock and Roll All Night.
Yeah, I remember you. We talked about this, like, because it's a kind of a slasher movie. I thought maybe you had seen it, but you thought it was like some Bogart thing or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, I want to just start by asking a basic question. What does it mean to be dressed to kill?
I don't know. Ask Gene Simmons.
I always took it to mean, you know, for whatever reasons, I think we associate that phrase with women specifically. I guess guys can dress to kill as well. But we think of it, it plays into the idea of a femme fatale, right? Like, someone that looks so good and seductive, there must be something bad about them. They're going to hurt us. Kill us.
Well, and I don't even know if killing means necessarily like the physical act. It's much more sexual. And I think, yeah, often applied to women.
Okay. Like I say, my association, if you've seen that album cover, it's got all four guys from Kiss in full face makeup wearing suits, like nice suits instead of their normal leather and boots. They're just in... You know, it looks like they're going to meet their lawyer.
Yeah, I think kill as in like when a comedian kills, you're impressing people.
I think the earliest I know of this phrase is it's an Arthur Conan Doyle Sherlock Holmes story. One of the classic Sherlock Holmes stories is Dressed to Kill.
Okay. I kind of knew in context what it meant, but in relation to Kiss and now Brian De Palma, I was like, okay, let me just start by... Because this title is a turn of phrase. It is not an original title. Coming into this movie, I didn't know what to expect. I knew nothing about this movie coming in. I didn't know who was in it. I knew just from some pre-conversations we had that it was going to be a murder mystery, and that was all.
Mm-hmm. And which version did you see? There, it's a very slight difference, but there is a theatrical and an extended. Extended by 1 minute. Basically, if you see Bush, you're seeing extended.
Okay, I saw the extended.
I saw the extended.
Okay, all right.
It's what iTunes had. I'm surprised. iTunes usually doesn't lean unrated as their only copy.
I think basically this was a film, not surprisingly, if you think about the 1980s, you're right. This is the same year as Cruising. A lot of people were trying to put out edgy 70s era content. You know, the whole sexual revolution had kind of like turned a seed. It felt like, oh, free love had now become this like sleazy bars and pickups where you're gonna get harmed, right? Like, it became these cautionary tales of like, if you go out there and live that lifestyle, you're not gonna live.
Yeah, I feel like we're gonna hit all those points at some point in this film.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we get into it then? Arnie, give us the plot. We'll find out about Dressed to Kill.
Nancy Allen is high-end New York sex worker Liz Blake. One afternoon, while leaving at John's apartment, she witnesses the murder of Kate Miller, played by Angie Dickinson. Liz gets a glimpse of the killer, a blonde woman in sunglasses. Police Detective Marino, played by Dennis I Only Play Cops Franz, doesn't believe Liz's story about the blonde woman, and Liz's client has disappeared, leaving the call girl with no corroboration. Yet she still sees the blonde woman, who now seems to be stalking Liz. When the mysterious blonde attacks Liz with a razor, Liz is rescued by Peter Miller, the son of murdered Kate, played by Keith Gordon. Since his mother's homicide, Peter has been using his technology skills to try and find the murderer. He believes the killer is a patient of psychiatrist Dr. Robert Elliott, played by Michael Caine. Elliott was Kate's therapist, and Liz and Peter team up to see if it was another patient that killed her. They don't know that Elliott's been receiving messages from a former patient named Bobby. Bobby was a transsexual who wanted gender reassignment surgery, but Dr. Elliott refused. Bobby has moved on to another therapist and leaves messages for Elliot discussing the murder of Kate. Desperate for a lead, Liz goes to see Dr. Elliot and attempts to seduce him, all as a cover for looking at his patient's schedule and trying to find the killer's name. However, Liz gets Dr. Elliot aroused, and that brings forward Elliot's other personality, Bobby. Elliot suffers from multiple personality disorder, and whenever Elliot gets aroused, Bobby takes over and tries to murder the subject of Elliot's desire. A police officer shoots Elliot and saves Liz. You see, Detective Marino had assigned an officer to watch over Liz for her safety. Kate's killer is revealed, and Elliot is sentenced to a sanitarium, though Liz still has nightmares about being stalked by the killer, as credits roll.
As they start, I feel like this movie has some infamous scenes. Even if you've never seen it before, if you've heard about it, you know it's got to have a shower scene. There's so much psycho here. This always gets talked about. We have 48-year-old Angie Dickinson, TV star. She was a lady cop for so many seasons. And here she is in her full glory, although I think there's some assist from a centerfold for some of the extreme close-ups.
Penthouse pets of the year, because I guarantee you, when I saw that close-up, I'm like, those ain't no 40-something boobs.
What's amazing is I realized it this time. It's the same shots we get in Psycho, minus the one where it's her pubic area, but like the same shots without the knife. He actually like cuts it in the same way as when Janet Leigh gets killed in the shower. But here, she's masturbating.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. That's what I wrote down in my notes with the question mark. Like, she is super turned on by watching her husband shave or something, because she's really enjoying herself in that shower.
Or she just really wants to be clean. I mean, she doesn't spend a whole lot of time downtown. She just goes down there with a soap bar.
Oh, come on. This is a Freudian movie. We're going to meet a psychoanalyst. Like, we're to look at this. Like, what does dreams mean? Like, let's go ahead and do this. Here's a woman that has all of this sexual energy, and her husband would rather be shaving or doing anything else than paying her attention. And when he's actually on top of her, it feels like assault. She has this impression of a man coming up behind, holding her mouth closed and taking her from the rear.
And I was wondering that, because we're going to end with the whole dream thing. Is this all a fantasy, this whole shower scene that she's using to get through this really awful sex? I don't know, maybe because it ends in a rape, murder in that shower? I'm not sure. Maybe that's her metaphor for awful sex. That's what it feels like.
Sexual dissatisfaction. That's what I would say. That's what we're watching in this opening.
And you may be making a lot of callbacks to Hitchcock, Stuart, but you know what I see echoed a lot in this movie is De Palma himself with Carrie.
Oh, yes.
And Carrie started with that shower scene, which
yes.
was a little bit, had some lingering looks at teenage breasts and some pretty flowery music playing like we have here, and then would go into violence there. And yeah, I see a lot of parallels. This opening shot is the first.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because one thing that always gets brought up when you read about Dress to Kill is how autobiographical this is. Which made me go, this crazy movie? What are you saying, autobiographical? But when you find out details about Brian De Palma's early life, you will see that there are connections in the story to things that happened to his mother, his father, himself. And I think that this movie is not only a reflection on Hitchcock, but a reflection on, yes, what Brian De Palma has already done with Hitchcock moves in movies like Carrie. It's semi-autobiographical as well as is a fan letter to Hitch.
So the next major character we meet, Peter, that's De Palma, right? Like the son?
You got it.
Who's doing some weird, crazy circuit that could hold up to 20 digits.
Yes. Not surprising Brian De Palma was a little nerd, right? We could all imagine, probably most filmmakers, certainly technicians and such, like, didn't have an appreciation yet for art. He's going to tell his mom, no, I'm not going to go to the art museum. I'm going to stay and work on this thing that I have no idea what it is, but it's science-y.
Yeah, it holds 20 digits.
It was a memory chip. It was a processor. And to be honest, if it could hold 20 digits, it's better than most processors were when I was going through grad school, where I had 8 memory units to use on a CPU, and that was it. But this is Keith Gordon, and he's one of those actors that I haven't seen him in all that much.
He's a director now.
Because of Christine and Legend of Billie Jean and Back to School, I'm always happy when he shows up in stuff. He's a comfortable presence. And so, yeah, this is the youngest I've seen him, I think.
Is his mom, Kate, happy to see him too? Like, she ends this whole thing like, you got to name your thing. Let's call it a Peter. You're working on your Peter. Like, that's also a nickname for a penis. Like, very Freudian.
Yeah, no, I don't. Again, I think this movie is encouraging these kinds of readings. And yes, the mother is very much a very sexual being, promoting the idea that her son needs to get away from science and all of that and appreciate beauty and come with me. Like, again, all that happens, and the reason why it does, is because this kid says no. Because he says no, going to the art museum becomes something else for this woman than a mother-child bonding experience. But I just want to point out, so, page from De Palma's life, his real mother was suicidal because she believed her husband was cheating on her. And she asked little Brian De Palma to help her prove it. The dad was, I guess, a podiatrist, and little Brian, like, I think he put cameras, maybe, in the doctor's office or sound equipment. I'm not sure what the technology was, but he did catch his dad with a nurse, and this gave the proof that, quote-unquote, saved his mom's life. He was able to give her the thing that allowed her, in that era, to be able to leave him and properly divorce him, because women really, that was an onus in that era. To divorce your husband would have been a blight on her, but with actual photographic proof that he was the cheater, she was able to move on. And so I do think when you know that story, this crazy movie suddenly feels really new and interesting. There's a new lens to look at all of this absurdity, a way that a Freudian psychiatrist would. Tell me more about your mother, Brian. And we get our psychiatrist, Michael Caine.
Who, because I had seen this before, I knew where it was going, but just picked up on a lot of little things that I missed the first time. Like, yeah, Kate comes in and the secretary's out of the way, so he has to play both roles, he'll point out.
Yeah, I thought that was an early, yeah, secretary work would be considered women's work. The fact that he was doing that at the same time, just a little tease. Interesting enough, Michael Caine, everyone knows he was in everything in the 70s and 80s, good and bad, Jaws, Revenge, and Sleuth. It didn't really matter to him. But they originally wanted Sean Connery for this. And I think that made more sense because Connery is a veteran of Hitchcock. They made Marnie together. I don't know if you've ever seen that one, but that's the movie that equates lesbianism with criminal behavior.
Yeah, and I think with Connery, I don't know, he's James Bond. He's a man's man. Like, maybe that would have fooled you longer. I do feel like they give things away pretty quickly as we get into the story.
Not knowing the twist of this movie, I did wonder, does Dr. Elliot have any of these people he talks about? We never see his secretary. We never see his wife that he talks about. Initially, it doesn't shock me that a therapist would mention being married, but the more time we spend with Elliot throughout this movie, the more I'm like, at some point, his wife should be wandering around. At some point, that secretary should show up.
Yeah, and he's always, like, looking in a mirror when he talks about that wife, too.
Yeah, you're catching the early clues. Good on you for that. I don't know that I would have picked up on that. I, of course, having seen this movie, if you've ever seen this movie, you remember the twist of this movie.
Yeah, you know where it's going.
You know, again, if you've seen Psycho, you might be picking up on where this movie is heading here. The thing that's shocking to me is that when they're having their therapy session, Kate is sitting down and talking about how unsatisfied she is with her husband, she, as patients are wont to do, turns it on him and makes it come on. Do you find me attractive? Normally, I think therapists would be like, we're not talking about me. We want to keep the focus on you. The fact that he's very brutally honest and says, yes, I would have sex with you, but I have these ethics. And he defines himself purely in terms of my wife prevents me from having these thoughts. Not to mention my job. Like, if you sleep with your patient,
yeah,
really bad therapist.
I guess looking at it now, Bobby is the wife.
Yeah, you could see it that way, I suppose. Yeah. We don't really know. In the same way that we didn't know Norman, other than he talked about mother up in the house, that's what the wife is. Yeah.
But I do feel like her getting turned down by her therapist, she just talked about this unsatisfying sex with the husband, like, that is what motivates her once she gets to the museum and starts going after this guy.
Right, yeah. In my memory of this movie, she was a woman that had been doing this, like, that was why she was seeking therapy, because she was just out there whoring around and doing all this behavior and wanted to stop. But in fact, she's just been a mom, an unsatisfied mom who has no outlet, who has a husband that can't satisfy her. Her, who has a child that she can't understand, who has a therapist that basically, yeah, prompts her to ask, what is your ethics? And so this sequence, this is another one of those sequences they always talk about.
It's a great sequence.
I mean, when he was talking about Dressed to Kill, most of it was about this 10 minutes here at the Modern Art Museum.
This is really well done. You know, it at first unnerved me because there is no dialogue, just sound effects and score. But the more it went on, the more I was really drawn into this kind of storytelling. And you say giallo, Jacob. That's something that I got thinking of was the overwrought facial expressions and also some of the way that they do kind of flashback there to, oh, where did I leave my glove? That kind of thing. It's a strange way to do the scene. I don't know what would motivate somebody to do it like this when it could be done much more standardly, but the result is much stronger for doing it.
Because it's all visual. You're just being pulled into it. And Stuart, if you're telling me that this is a Hitchcock ripoff, fine. I wish more people were ripping this off because it is a moment that sucks me in, and I wish most films could suck me in like this one does.
Yeah, that was my question to you guys, is have you seen Vertigo and did you make a connection to this moment?
I have seen Vertigo, but I didn't think of it with this moment.
Yeah, I kept, like, I was going through, I'm like, okay, this is the Psycho moment, here's this moment. I don't think we get a Birds moment, but I kept wondering, what is the Vertigo one? I haven't seen that one in a few years, so it wasn't fresh on my mind, but there's something, is this Jimmy Stewart, like, skulking around following that woman?
Let me just put it in perspective. So part of it, without spoiling it, go see the movie. It's one of maybe Hitchcock's most interesting. It's really bizarre. Like, it goes in places much like this movie you can't believe. It's the idea of chasing a phantom of a woman that may just be an illusion, who may just be a figure in a painting. And at one pivotal moment, Jimmy Stewart does go to an art museum and sees a woman sitting on this bench, exactly as we see Kate here sitting on this bench. And it plays a big game about who this woman really is. And voyeurism is a big theme in Hitchcock. It's Brian De Palma picking up that conversation and adding a little personal spice to this. Apparently, another autobiographical detail, this is how he picked up chicks in the 70s. If you want to know how to get a girl, you go to an art gallery. I think we even see that go down as she's looking around at the patrons. There's some families here, and then there's a guy that's hitting on a girl.
Oh, there's a couple. Yeah, he's grabbing her ass. Yeah.
There's the teenagers that grabbing each other, and then there's a guy that, like, just hitting on it. Makes me think that, like, it's just kind of funny to think that, like, you're supposed to like all these old paintings because they're beautiful, right? Because they're art. But maybe you just like the angle that it gives you that you can get laid. And I think this movie plays with that. Is it art, or is it just a trashy exploitation movie? The sequence begs both interpretations because, yeah, who can argue with the artistry here? It's really amazing to watch her turn where One moment she's like, I'm going to show you I have a wedding ring and I'm appalled that you would hit on me. And then you walk away and I go, oh no, I want you to, I want you to want me. I don't know if I want to go with you, but I want you to want me. So I'm going to chase you through this museum. And then I get busted and you're watching me look for you. You try to bring me my glove, which is, I mean, that goes back to Jane Austen books about the left behind party glove is always a symbol for somebody that, you know, goes and bonks the wrong person or whatever. But it's a trigger for her because notice he touches her on the neck. It makes her think about that dream. It makes her think about that man that's covering her mouth. And so she runs away and then realizes, oh, that's my glove, and goes back again. I mean, the way it goes back and forth, it is 10 minutes, but it is telling you a lot of information about her and what she wants.
And it's also Hitchcockian in the fact that this character is going to be knocked off. What she wants is fairly irrelevant 10 minutes after this scene.
Yeah, I had forgotten that since the first and only other time I had watched this. Like, this is the whole Psycho setup here.
Oh, you didn't realize that she was going to be taken out of the picture early?
Nope.
I mean, I asked that of the person that's seen the movie before, because I feel like that's the most famous twist of Psycho, is that Janet Leigh doesn't make it to the end.
Yeah, I didn't know that the first time I watched this, and I had forgotten that whole twist in this one. So it was, once again, a big surprise. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, here is the Psycho moment with Janet Leigh.
We spend so much time with Angie Dickinson here, with the therapist, learning about her. This 10-minute scene, yeah, I thought for sure this was our main character this movie, and I did not expect her to get knocked off because, like you said, Stuart, this is a very artistic scene. You learn a lot about the characters through their wordless interaction, yet it's slightly frustrating that it ends up being like a short film about a character whose motivations become moot in regards to the rest of the film.
I disagree with that second part, but I do agree that it becomes a different film, obviously, after she's taken out of the picture. And it will be a big surprise, I think, to anyone. Even if you've seen Hitchcock Illusions, you wouldn't necessarily believe that Angie Dickinson, again, a big TV star at the time, on all the posters, this would be a big reason why people would go. And she plays a moral person. You know, she plays a cop on TV. Here she is flirting with the idea of maybe I'm going to have an affair that is going to kill her. I mean, I don't know. I guess that is the morality of the slasher films of the time. But I think you would expect her to be the last girl, at the very least.
Yeah, and I think they really do fool you. Like, they draw out, like, I thought we're getting a whole storyline, especially the first time I saw this, because she goes back to that guy's place. They start getting it on in that taxi where she leaves her panties. But she's, like, going to slip out and leave and, like, going through his drawers to see who he is, leave him a note. You've tested positive for a venereal disease. I guess that's how they announce it to you from the doctors when you have one, but like...
In the 70s, maybe.
Yeah. But I'm like, here's a whole other layer to this story. Like, she's got to break this to her husband now. But like, no, this is like her almost final moments.
Yeah, I mean, my dad worked for public health, and you do have to contact people that are spreading VD. That was his department. That is exactly how they would get a hold of people. They would talk to people who had it. Who were your partners? Sometimes they would know names. Sometimes they wouldn't. And you would send letters, or you would make phone calls, or you would, you know, go show up to the bars and ask questions. There were different ways of doing it. But yes, pre-internet, this is what it looks like here.
Yeah, this looked like he had had some tests, because it's like you tested positive for venereal disease. I'm surprised that it would just go venereal disease. I was curious, like gonorrhea, syphilis, are we talking herpes?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think the whole point is this is kind of a meta moment. Like, it's a little hyper-real. It wouldn't just be generic VD.
Yeah.
You would want to know. But again, this is, I think, Brian De Palma talking about the morality of all of this. This is a woman that's sitting there at the museum, was going, looking back and forth between lovers and families. What is she going to do? She's made the dangerous choice, and now she really has to pay. Because, yeah, even though she can crawl out of this situation and never have to see this man again, Bobby is on to her. Even if you look at the museum scene, I don't know if you caught it, but there are two times that we see the killer. Once there's just a pan down the stairs and Bobby is just standing there as she's walking up to the taxi cab and he's holding out the white glove. And then you saw her throw the other glove away. There's a black gloved hand that goes and grabs that. That lets you know that Bobby is watching Kate's every move. That's why she can be in the stairwell watching her get into the elevator. Probably the most famous sequence in this movie. The shower scene.
Yeah, this really does feel like a giallo. Put like a red or orange or green tint on the camera. And like, I would have believed this was filmed in Italy. Like, just all that slashing and blood. Like, it's not realistic, but it's the way I'd want it in this kind of film.
So what if she hadn't forgotten her ring?
Well, she was being watched. He would have got her at some point, I think.
That's the metaphorical point. Like, you forgot your family. And they even put, like, a mother and child getting in the elevator, and the child's giving her that "how could you" look the whole time. Like, the shaming that she's feeling at this moment. Again, it's really underlining the metaphor behind this death. I don't think anyone can miss that it's because she stepped out on this relationship. She didn't honor her husband, and that's why she's going to die.
Yeah, if she didn't try to turn on Dr. Elliot, then none of this would have happened.
I don't mean metaphorically. I'm saying in regards to Dr. Elliot's point of view as Bobby the murderer, was he just waiting around and he was lucky she went back up the elevator?
Yeah, we saw a POV coming out of the stairwell and going towards that and the door slamming his face. He doesn't look like a runner to me, particularly in that dress. So I think that, yeah, he probably was just sitting there going, shit, I guess I'll take the next one. Maybe I can catch her on the street. I know where she lives. Again, I've been tailing her all this time. I don't think that Kate would have escaped, but it is awfully convenient that Kate can die, much like her dream, the shower scene there or the shower scene in Psycho. As she goes back up to Seven, the doors part, and we see not Michael Caine. I just want to point out, it is her therapist dressed to kill, but that is not Michael Caine in a wig and lipstick. That is actually the actress that will be playing the cop that is also following Liz later.
Oh, really? Because I felt like that was a very mannish silhouette. And the first time I watched this, I'm like, oh, they're not even going to try to hide the fact that it's a crossdresser.
The blonde seemed very tall, and that looked like an obvious wig. And Michael Caine is shown as very tall in several scenes, so I did figure out who the killer was before the end. And looking at this blonde here was part of what tipped me to that direction. So the fact that it's not him shocks me.
Yeah, well, again, they're playing games here. If you think about Vertigo, there is a woman that is always being pursued, and we can't be sure if it's Kim Novak or this imposter, or Kim Novak is actually pretending to be someone else at a certain point. Too many secrets, I'm not going to give it away. But again, the idea of who is this real woman, it's meant to build up larger existential questions about who the characters are. And it also just kind of really works, because you wouldn't, if it were Michael Caine in a dress, somebody would guess it at this point. This movie wouldn't be able to pull the surprise that it's hoping you don't figure out till the end.
But even if you don't think this is Michael Caine, it looks like a man in women's clothes.
Yes.
Okay, but I ask, you guys at this point, yes, a transsexual killer is what we're going to hear about very soon. We're going to cut to Michael Caine in his office. He's going to play Bobby on his answering machine, and we do know that there is a character that feels like they are a girl trapped in a man's body and wanting to kill women, or at least Kate. So when did you know? I guess that's my question. When did you know who Bobby was?
I felt like I knew the first time I watched this when he goes to the mental hospital looking for Bobby. Like, that's when things started to click for me.
That's when it all clicked for me, too, is when he's talking about Bobby to that other therapist and asked, do you know why Bobby came to see me? And the answer was no.
The way that therapist is looking at him, like, something's off.
And again, how tall the blonde was and everything. It would have been really unsatisfying if in the very last scene we meet Bobby, who we'd been talked about this whole time and we'd never seen them before. I figured the killer was among us. And so Michael Caine, as the most isolated personality here and the only one to have any contact with Bobby. And I got to admit, Stuart told me, if you've seen Psycho, you'll see shades of Psycho in this. And I think that might have been in my mind. I was like, okay, it's Dr. Elliot.
Well, and that would be my point here is, like, if you were really thinking that there's a lot of Psycho here, then this would feel like the shower scene. You would immediately conclude that the killer, I mean, if the killer in Psycho, sorry to spoil this movie, but you should really know by now. Go listen to the show. But if the killer is Anthony Perkins in drag, then it's probably going to follow suit here, that Michael Caine is doing it as well. The reason why he could resist the urge to sleep with Angie Dickinson in his office is because he has this other personality that was taking over. But what's not in Psycho is the idea that in the middle of the shower scene, it gets interrupted by another character, Nancy Allen, Brian De Palma's real life wife.
Okay, that's why she's always showing up in his films.
Yeah, it's not because she's a good actress.
Nope.
She's awful, always.
She does pretty well here. I mean, I didn't like her in Blowout, which we covered in our book. I thought she was good in Carrie. I actually really like her in this movie.
She's not detrimental in this movie. Agreed. She normally is.
If that's his wife, why is she always like a prostitute in his films?
Well, again, tell me more about your mother, Mr. De Palma. Like, I do feel like this feels like a therapy session where a man is allowing his movies or his dreams to be read with a Freudian subtext. Yeah, what is he really saying about himself that he would present his wife in this way, that he would present his childhood story in this way? I agree. It invites all kinds of interpretations and is really brave. I do feel like the only protection he has is most people probably wouldn't believe any of this was autobiographical. It feels too absurd to be true.
Yeah, this is what the Coen brothers would have done. To have a prostitute with a heart of gold that wants to save people and also invest in the stock market and art.
I love that because it takes you a long time. It's not until Dennis Franz is throwing her rap sheet in her face that you realize that Nancy Allen's character, Liz, at least I didn't, that she doesn't look like a call girl to me. She looks like a businesswoman talking about stocks when she's standing there at the elevator. So 10 minutes later to find out that, yeah, okay, she wasn't just having an affair with a guy, like that was her doing her job and she's part of an escort service. I feel like all of this is well calibrated and you will be surprised even if you have guessed the big twist, is I guess what I would say.
Oh yeah, there is so much interesting stuff going on here. Like, yeah, that twist is just one thing, one aspect of this film. There's so much more to it.
Again, if Brian De Palma weren't as good as he is with the camera, you couldn't believe, as scripted, that the killer would suddenly drop this. You know, he did cut up Angie Dickinson, and in the extended version, you really do see. In the theatrical version, it feels like, what, he slashed her hand, she'll live. But, like, in this extended version, she gets the throat, the cheek, like, she's dead, dead, dead.
Oh, yeah.
So you got to see the extended version, then, if you're going to watch one cut.
Yeah, it makes pretty clear that there's no calling the paramedics for her here. Then after that's done, like, he knows there's a woman standing at the open door, is ready to, like, cut off her fingers if she reaches in to help this woman, and then ends up dropping the switchblade, and Nancy Allen is mistaken as the killer by a cleaning lady. Like, crazy! What yes. are you talking about? Stupid!
And that was a really weird scene, the way that Liz, Nancy Allen's character, I'll call her by her character name Liz, is just kind of like in a dream when she sees this woman there. I think you'd have a fight or flight reaction. She just kind of has this long, languid pause of watching her customer just gets the hell out of there while she just stays there and slowly raises her hand and tries to reach out.
Well, one of the things that always gets brought up about Dressed to Kill and every Brian De Palma movie and a lot of Hitchcock movies is voyeurism. Our need to watch other people, what we get out of it, how we hope to be perceived and all of that. So it's just worth noting in this movie, this is a movie about people looking at other people and experiencing it through different lenses. You know, like literally like she's seeing the killer, but it's only because they have one of those circular mirrors in the corner that allows, you know, like, I guess for that reason, like you can see who's in the elevator even when you're standing outside of it. I guess that's a way of not getting an elevator with a killer with a razor. But yes, the idea is that she's been spared the same fate as this other woman.
The point is so you don't actually hit somebody around a corner with those mirrors.
Oh, is you're like pushing a cart or something? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
That's the nice version of it. I mean, I think it has multiple purposes, but yes, it is used in this case for her to be able to see what could become of her. And that brings us back to the morality of this hooker that if she keeps living this lifestyle might wind up just like this 48-year-old woman bleeding out here in the elevator.
And you talk about all the ways we view stuff in this film. It's also how we gather information is Peter, or I guess we could call him Brian De Palma, like he has bugged the police office. So when they're interrogating Liz, like that's how we're getting all that information by listening in along with Peter.
Mm-hmm. And another thing worth pointing out, Brian De Palma loves to do it in all movies, and sometimes it really makes no sense, Bonfire of the Vanities, but he loves to have split screens.
The split diopter.
Yeah, the broken focus so that what's in the foreground is equally in focus with what's in the background. It feels hyper-realistic. You've realized that this is a stylistic, not realistic choice, but I think it, for this movie particularly, which is about so much about split personalities, it's right to always be carving carving up the screen.
I think it's a really polite look at sex workers here in this movie, though, because normally you would see them as somewhat demonized, or at least you wouldn't see them as stock investing art buyers.
Liz is the smartest character in this film. Well, maybe Peter is, too. He created that circuit.
Well, later she's going to be talking about she bought this painting for $500 that'll be worth $1 million one day. I mean, she's a hustler. She's trying to better herself. I think that's the story of Pretty Woman, right? She's trying to find her $1 million prince. Like, she doesn't want to do this work. To me, it feels like it plays into a stereotype. But you're saying it feels kinder than some portrayals.
The hooker with the heart of gold is a stereotype, but to find one that is also articulate and thinks about things like stock tips when she gets one from her John and all that sort of thing, and just very matter of fact about her business. She needs an appointment so she can get the stocks bought. It just felt non-judgmental.
That feels like a prostitute to me. I mean, it helps that I saw Clute. Jane Fonda was a very similar character 8 years before. In my estimation, sex workers tend to be financially frugal and working on a plan, like risky business. I feel like we get that a lot.
I'm just saying, for 1980, yes, risky business and trading places. I remember Jamie Lee Curtis's speech.
Right. She had a whole plan, right? She had like a portfolio. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. See, to me, it's not a different portrayal at all, but it does, maybe it makes you like her more. You're invested more in this woman. Again, we don't know she's a sex worker until the cops are going to throw it in her face. But yeah, we are able to make the jump from Angie Dickinson to Nancy Allen pretty well here at the police station because of the way they trade the story of one into the story of the new victim. We know Bobby leaves a message with Dr. Elliot that he knows that this woman saw and will get her too. So she's going to be the next victim.
Yeah, if not a victim of Bobby, a victim of the police, because she's got 48 hours to find that John who could testify that she's not the killer.
Right, which is just, I mean, again, we know that when she's calling the escort service and then like, when is he back in town? 2 weeks. Can I get his phone number? No. I mean, like, yeah, you're not going to, nobody that hired you is going to want to come downtown with you and tell the cops what they did and what they saw. This guy saw a bloody woman in an elevator and ran, like, out the door, never to come back to New York again, probably.
Yeah, after committing a crime by soliciting a prostitute. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's reason enough to run, is you don't want your wife to find out. And if you're standing there next to a dead body, your wife's finding out.
And that's happening in parallel. We see that's why Peter is there, is that the, well, to him, it's a stepfather, but the husband of Kate is coming to see the body and learn that what his wife was doing. And Peter has got that eavesdropping equipment and is hearing all the gory details. My mother spent all day with a stranger and then got hacked up in an elevator. Like, no punches pulled.
He seems strangely unaffected by all of this. Maybe it's Keith Gordon's acting ability. Maybe it's an underwritten character. But he seems strangely okay with everything that's going on. He does have one moment of petulance when he's saying, that's not my father, that's my stepfather. And we never see the stepfather in this movie again. It's like he doesn't really have parents at all anymore. But he just seems to go with it and much more into solving the mystery for the mystery's sake than he is into mourning his mother and shocked by her behavior.
Yeah, I do feel like he goes about this very clinically.
Yeah, I think there's been a transference. Like, the mother becomes Nancy Allen at this point. I can't save my mother, but I can save this other woman or whoever is going to get it next. I don't think he's unaffected by it at all. Unaffected would mean like, mom's dead. I'm going to go back and work on my science project. He goes back and builds a camera that can be planted discreetly outside the doctor's office and taking a picture of every person that comes in and out of the place because he's going to find out who did it.
And to me, that feels like working on his science project to a degree. He's looking at new technologies and building it. It's like he's playing a game around his mother's murder versus emotionally impacted by his mother's murder.
Oh, I agree with that. He's not letting the emotions of grief to overcome him. He is going to solve this problem from a science, how do I work this? I can figure this out kind of way, rather than feel sad that, oh my God, my mother's dead and it's kind of my fault because I didn't go to the museum with her.
Yeah, we'll never get that scene where he expresses that kind of grief.
That is a real long chain of dominoes to blame him for his mother's death.
No, if your mom's like, hey, come out with me, and then she ends up dead, like, I would be racked with guilt. Like, if I was there, would it have ended up differently?
Yeah, the plan was, when she went into his room and saying, you ready to go to the museum? And he's like, no, I want to work on my thing. If he had gone with her, she wouldn't have hooked up with stranger on a bench.
But you say he's capturing everyone going in and out of this therapist's office. We'll see him, like, I guess he sets up a time-lapse camera, like, every 4 seconds it's going to take a picture. My question is, like, they never call out that they don't see Bobby going in. They capture Bobby coming out.
I thought the same thing. Yeah, you see her coming out, wouldn't you notice that nobody ever went in?
Yeah. If you didn't want to reveal the surprise of the movie, you would let that detail slip out. But yes, I think that would be really notable. That, yes, the killer came out but never went in. Not observed.
It's something I caught.
Oh, you did? Okay.
That we see everybody else in and out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That would be another clue. But again, I think film fans of Psycho are already onto this. And I don't know that Brian De Palma is thinking everyone is fooled. I feel like this movie is as much a film comment on Hitchcock and Psycho. Like, I don't think it would bother him if people walked into the movie spoiled, knowing all of the twists, because I think he's doing other things.
Yeah, if he's doing a postmodern twist on Psycho where Hitchcock went to such great lengths to keep people spoiler-free from that, like, yeah, this one, I don't know, I'm going to do some lazy storytelling or sloppy storytelling, and you'll figure it out pretty early. Who cares?
Yeah, I'll distract you with tits, like, is what it feels like. Like, you really came for that anyway. Feels like the secret message of all of this is like, yeah, we could talk about all voyeurism and all of that, but you're a voyeur too. You're sitting in that theater watching all of this. Don't tell me you're not a pervert.
Yeah, Blowout was his next film, right? Because these do feel very close thematically.
They do. I was thinking Blowout a lot, and Blowout's the one he made right after this one.
Yeah, and again, another movie that references a lot, but a different director, Antonioni's Blow Up, as opposed to anything Hitchcock. But it has Hitchcock flourishing. I don't think anything Brian De Palma has made doesn't have an influence of Hitchcock in it. Anyway, speaking of technique, let's talk about split screens, because we get around the 55-minute mark. Really, one of the most impressive ones. As impressive as the museum chase scene, we see Dr. Elliot coming home and Liz coming home, and them juggling lots of different information that feels like the same story being told at the same time.
No, this is a really impressive scene, like a lot of information being given. I love that it ends like two different views. Like, we get the close-ups, I think, from Dr. Elliot's point of view of Donahue talking about transsexuals. And then it's just kind of playing in the background on Liz's TV while she's going to like buying stocks or whatever.
Everybody's watching Donahue in 1980.
Yeah, do people know who that is? I feel like we need to tell them this was Oprah before Oprah. He really was, like, the pioneer of the talk show format, like, daytime. It feels like this is happening in the evening. I feel like he was more of a 3 o'clock kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that did throw me off a little.
Right, but, you know, anyway, this movie's not big on the reality of anything. But the idea that as we have this commentary on what being trans is, we have Dr. Elliot listening to the latest Bobby audio tape where the killer is like, yeah, I'm going to find that girl and cut her eyes out. And then we see a blonde woman with binoculars looking up at this apartment, very rear window.
Yep.
And we see Liz juggling two different phone calls. I'm talking to my broker and I'm talking to the escort service, and I'm going to try and book enough sex so that I can buy that stock that guy told me about before he ran away.
I know we talked a lot about Liz's character, but it just hit me. If we're talking about characters with dual natures, like, yeah, the prostitute and the stock investor, like, there you go.
And the Donahue stuff felt like explaining to an audience what transsexualism is. It was like, yes, a real data dump here. Being done with all this other stuff going on, it might be what people pay attention to the absolute least, but yet, looking back at 41 years ago, the idea of sex changes and things probably were still brand new concepts to some people. And there's a couple scenes here that feel almost like health class, and this is one of them.
I did think it was kind of interesting. It doesn't feel like they try to conflate it with homosexuality and, like, it's, you know, effeminate guys are the ones that are going to become transsexuals. Like, we see this one on Donahue being a macho guy and says lots of macho guys become women. So it feels like it's trying to differentiate a little bit to me.
I feel like this movie is rightly attacked. If you're coming to it, yeah, for sex, actual politics. This thing is way retrograde, in the same way that Psycho, you know, Psycho said homosexual men get attached to their mothers. That's the reason why they're gay, and then they'll kill you. So now we have, yes, the 1980 version is, boy, if you are having gender dysmorphia, it probably means one side wants to kill everyone you find desirable on the other side of yourself.
Which I get why that's problematic, but I do think they make a strange case. Like, yeah, people should get this operation. Maybe they go about for the wrong reasons, but like they do argue like that it's not a bad thing.
I mean, I realized there were a lot of movies around this time. I'm thinking 10 to Midnight that I saw recently. And yes, Psycho.
I mean, we had Dog Day Afternoon, which was an Oscar nominee, which was all about this.
And keep in mind, he was going to do Cruising and made this instead.
But there were a lot of criminal gays in movies around this time.
The criticism against it is correct, that this perpetuates a long-standing, and we're talking about not just at this time, the history of cinema is that being gay is abnormal and will lead to abnormal. There's no difference between gay and psychopath. Like, that's pretty much along, like, the history of gays in cinema is that narrative. And here's what I would say. I don't think this movie is that concerned about it. I don't think that may offend you and that may, like, make you want to not watch this movie. And I completely understand. I see this more. This is just my reading of it this time. I'm Brian De Palma. I'm going to put on Hitchcock drag. I'm going to wear this other, and maybe you're going to think me desirable because I look like Hitchcock, or maybe you're going to think I'm desirable because I look like Brian De Palma, or maybe you'll just like me because I'm some version in between that is like never seen before. But being trans is a metaphor. He is not concerned about the actual psychology of what that experience is like. And so consequently, that may piss people off. I get it. It's not a good movie to watch if you want, you know, Boys Don't Cry. There are other films to address the predicament of being trans in a world that does not accept you. This movie, don't do it. It's cruel.
Yeah, I think De Palma is much more concerned with being trashy, like in an artistic way. Like, I don't say that as a bad thing, but yeah, I do think he wants to be provocative. And, you know, there's so much skin showing in this and that extended cut with the pubic hair and all that. Like, that feels like the movie he's really concerned with, not the, yeah, transgender politics.
I do think, though, that through the Donahue stuff and things, this isn't a totally stigmatized portrayal.
Explain that. In what way is it kind?
Well, the woman on Donahue discussing her transition is being treated very fairly, and Donahue is going out of his way to try to ask sensitive questions. Then, very late in the film, we're going to get a semi-detailed discussion of gender reassignment surgery in a way that does not feel judgmental. It feels like a data dump that would be answering audience questions if they were curious about this.
Oh, I didn't take it that way at all. There's a woman, there's an old lady at the next table that's hearing every word, and she is plenty of judging. And I think she mirrors the audience reaction.
Well, yeah, I feel like that's a joke. Yeah, I was laughing at her.
Well, that was funny. I thought that was just a comedic beat in the background.
I think this movie is about people that watch other people, and I think that's another example of it.
I get what Arnie is saying because, again, so much of the speech is clinical, I understand, from how they're portrayed as killers of this. Yes, that's awful. But I feel like for 1980, it's more progressive than you'd probably expect.
Yes, that's where I'm standing, is that.
I would never use that word. But by that, you're saying that because there's a moment in a talk show where we see a trans person that has not done anything criminal, that is the only positive moment that we get in this movie that otherwise insists if you have this condition, you're going to be picking up razors and going after women.
I think the discussion at the end with Bobby's therapist says that this person had a special situation. Look, I don't want to like die on this hill.
Yeah, me either.
It's got issues, but it was more impressive than I would have. It's not like they're making jokes about it in this.
And I also feel like Liz is a lot of our point of view character, and she's so non-judgmental in the conversation about it that I feel like it's being told that, you know, this is just a thing that we should roll with.
Yeah, but we judge her. Again, like, I feel like there's a lot of sordid behavior here. The only innocent, really, is the kid. But I do want to say that this movie a big part of its audience. It was a big hit. I just want to put out there, as big a hit as Carrie, this movie made over $30 million in its initial theatrical run and ran on cable all the time, and was a big favorite with gay audiences. They just liked the representation. Positive or not, at this time, it was rare to see a mainstream movie that would even go here. And so, yeah, things like Cruising and this were positive or negative. It shows New York gay life in some kind of light. And that was better than being invisible.
Speaking of New York life, I just want to shout out that, again, I think De Palma's great at making the city a character. And while it's not quite as touristy as some films in New York are, again, to be seeing the subway system of 1980 and just way pre-Giuliani, down in the dumps, dirty New York is an atmosphere that I loved in Taxi Driver and I'm liking here.
Yeah, it's my favorite version of hell. If you want to say what, like, who made hell look the best, it was the 70s in New York City. That is my idea.
You're hoping to be threatened with gang rape when you go to hell, like in this film. Yeah.
Yeah, it really does feel like the worst thing I could imagine. And yet, it having its own with the lights and all of that, there's something inviting about it, as there is with hell, like, and doing bad things. And this movie is playing with that of, like, there's a part of us that is abhorred by everything that we're seeing, and there's a part of us that now is going to go along and, yeah, try and save this prostitute from the life. And we have in parallel Peter trying to, yeah, find who the killer is when they leave the therapist's office, and Liz trying to get that money. We saw, it was interesting, during the split screen, she books a job for 8:30, and then we can look over on the other side and Michael Caine's side and see that it's 7:30. So we know she's got an hour to, like, go to this place, and then we get a chase scene. We get Bobby has caught up, or at least we think it's Bobby. The person outside with the binoculars has found her, and there's a car chase.
Not the world's most exciting car chase.
I do love the line, how much will it cost me for you to run a red light?
And again, it's a cliche of, we now expect it, of slasher movies of this time. The killer is here, you know, okay, we got away from him, and then they pop up at the tree that we just ran to. We just accept that in the premise of those dumb movies. Okay, that's how that works. But you may not realize there are two pursuers. You may not get, I certainly don't, watching this movie, that actually the cabbie knocks down the cop that's pursuing, and the killer is waiting on the other side of the subway.
I never got that, and I think they may cheat with that cop's hairstyle a little bit. Later in the movie, when we're introduced to the cop, it doesn't look as much like the blonde's wig as it does when she falls down here.
Because it's a wig. I mean, she's dressing up.
But why would the cop be wearing a wig?
She's got blonde hair. She's got this short blonde hair. We'll see that at the end. That's not a wig.
Yeah, I mean, they're doing that because that's the Vertigo game.
Right, but I'm saying when she's knocked down by the cop here, she's wearing that wig.
Yeah, I'm trying to play in my mind, would she in any way be trying to look like the killer? Or would they? Yes. I mean, was that a thought?
I thought that was a total joke at the end when they reveal that. That she just happens to look like the killer.
Yeah, no, I feel like that may have been the point. That they intentionally, they took the statement from her downtown and then had the cop pursue dressed like what she described in the elevator.
I don't understand why that would be at all.
Because Dennis Franz is a jerk.
Yeah, because Dennis Franz, we'll find out his ultimate plot is, I was trying to get this therapist to give me his records, but he said no, and there's a whole, like, legalese that's going to block me from getting access to them.
Well, it's just a search warrant. It's going to take forever to get that warrant.
So maybe I can scare this woman. I can just have her believe that the killer is, like, right around the corner and chasing her around. I'll scare her in doing crime, because she's good at that, and breaking in and getting the records. And then I can just, you know, I can still be the moral cop and do the good thing because she's the one that did the crime.
I believe he's doing that, but I don't think he sent that cop out to dress like the described witness.
I'm on Arnie's side here.
Oh, okay. Why else would she look like that, though?
Yeah, I think they're just lying to the audience at that point. She shouldn't look like that when she's knocked down.
I'll do the movie the favor to saying that they were trying to scare her. That this was them pretending to be what she claimed was chasing her. Or saw that in the elevator.
See, that just makes no sense to me.
It puts extra pressure on her. Because she might not otherwise do it. If you believe you're going to get arrested and you're a hooker, that's one thing. If you believe you're going to get killed, you might go the extra mile.
I think it's a kind turn to Dennis Franz's character at the end. We're supposed to think, oh, he wasn't so bad. He actually sent a cop to protect her.
No, I did not. Not to protect her at all.
No, I never came around to his character.
No, I think it's to scare her. I think that this was to push her over the edge into doing the crime.
Well, we'll agree to disagree. That's not how I read this at all. And I feel like her in that wig when she's knocked down by the taxi driver is a complete cheat this movie does.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, it's just having fun at this point, having you guess and be wrong about where people are at and who they are. And I mean, it's thrilling. I will say this, Brian De Palma claimed to be a master of suspense. And some of these moments, just flat out, whether you buy the premise or not, when she's on the train platform and looking behind her and the people behind are looking out to see if the train's coming and maybe that's Bobby, maybe it's not. All of that's good.
Yeah, when she's going through each car to try to get away from that gang as they approach her, like, you could cut this and it wouldn't really matter, like, I think for the story. But again, it's a scene that pulls me in because just visually it's interesting.
I like that they introduced this gang because it shows there's more dangers in New York. You're running from one thing and you run right into another. And yeah, you know, it may not be the most, you know, if you're going to talk about bad portrayals of transsexuals, yes, the only black people here happen to be a gang that seems to want to beat her up and rape her, but...
Not true. That she runs to a black cop, and the black cop is like...
Yeah, who doesn't believe her?
Yeah, well, because she knows she'll replace her hand. Okay, I'm being chased by a gang. Okay, where are they? They're not here. And I'm also being chased by a crazy blonde woman. All right, lady, I got no time for you. Like, you could just see him shut down at that point. And the joke is that just beyond that car door is the crazy blonde woman with the razor blade.
Yeah, she's looking through the window.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever follows that sign that says, do not transfer between cars.
No, I didn't either when I rode subways. No, you always move to the next one. The air conditioner could be broken for lots of reasons. Somebody like shit in the chair. Like, yes. Yeah, you gotta leave the train cars. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
And I love the fact that like when the gang can see that she's about to be killed, that's when they're like, okay, never mind. They're turning away. Like, we're not going to help on that. We were going to harass her. But now that we see that she's going to possibly be slashed up, not my problem. Good thing that Peter has been on the case and has some homemade mace and can save her in this moment.
In that kind of close space, they should have all been crying, but I guess it's his special Peter mace.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Again, this character is as fantastical as any of the others. It's not about realism, but it's an extrapolation of, yeah, if you think about little Brian De Palma trying to help his mom any way he can with these science experiments to find out, to give her the means to get out of the situation that may kill her. I think there's something kind of sweet about the one-sided relationship he develops with Liz.
Who's on which side of that? Maybe it's my own teenage mind thinking, but if I were him, I'd be trying to sleep with this hooker.
I think he comes around to that by the end.
Yeah, that's an obvious thought. Again, that he's starting to think less about the mechanics and more about the passion. Yes, that is his journey, as it were, after he can process and save her from the fate of his mom. That, yeah, he's like, and now I'm ready to sleep with you. I mean, this is Freudian conflicts.
And I don't know where she stands on that. She'll later talk about how she does have sex for free with men that turn her on, and she seems interested in the cab driver to get his number or give him her number.
I mean, to get a free ride. She didn't pay for the cab fare. Like, that was, I'll go on a date with you. Like, that was how he got paid. It's all transactional.
No, I definitely feel like she's going for Peter in this. Like, she's willing to do it.
Oh, no, no. No, no, no. I mean, he sleeps on the couch. Like, she doesn't really... I'm just going to put it out there. She is an opportunist. Like, this is what she's doing. It's a calculation. She does protect him. I'll put it that way. When she goes back to Dennis Franz and he's like, you still got one more day before I lock you up. She doesn't say, I have a witness. She doesn't describe that I have this kid that can verify that there was a killer blonde after me.
Yeah, instead, she's going to do the craziest plot you could think of. Not just go to Dr. Ellie, but like full on ready to seduce him.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta think that sex is very transactional with her. And so that if she did have to sleep with him to get the evidence, that wouldn't be the worst trade she's made.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think it's hard for her.
No, I'm not even thinking about it from her point of view. Just from a storytelling point of view, like, it seems kind of out there. I go with it because that's the kind of film this is. But yeah, this is not realism. This is slutty Hitchcock, I guess.
You say that, but again, keep in mind, a mother asked her son to spy on their father having sex with a nurse, their doctor father. So, like, there is some basis here in this climax to something that happened. And it also feels like Rear Window, because he's standing outside in the rain, going binoculars from one window to the other, as she's trying to find those, you know, the name of the last person, the last patient, and whatever Elliot is doing. Because we've had, at this point, that scene you talked about him going to the psychiatric hospital. And probably, I'm going to just say 80% of the audience knows that he's the killer.
And I was really distracted when he goes to that ward. I'm like, Dr. Levy, I know this actor. Who is this actor? He's the mayor from Ghostbusters.
Yep, I recognized him right away.
Oh, yeah. I did not recognize him. Okay, but yes, in the original. Yep, I remember him.
And part two, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I know him from, but man, was I distracted by him in this movie.
So, yeah. So then we just get a thriller climax where the girl's in peril and the hero that's watching has to do something. But what's going on out there? Like, he gets grabbed from someone. It can't be Bobby, because we know Bobby is inside. The lightning is crackling and we can see that the blonde with the switchblade is standing behind Liz as she's watching out the window what's happening to her partner, Peter.
Peter getting grabbed and everything, and somebody from the outside shooting in. Felt like a convenient cheat, a little Deus Ex Machina. I mean, I realized that the blonde following her had been set up, but that she grabs Peter at this moment and that she's the one to pull the trigger. I feel like Peter should have been the one to save the day here. It avenged his mother. We didn't need this cop coming in out of nowhere.
Oh, I felt like this was the big tricked you thriller movie type moment. Like, where, you thought Michael Caine was the killer. Maybe she's still outside, or he's still outside getting Peter. Like, how could they be in the same place at the same time?
Right. They've done that twice now.
And again, that's kind of a cheat, though.
Yeah, but that's what these movies do. Like, that's what happens in any thriller.
There you go. That's what a thriller is. It cheats and makes you think things and then says, ha ha, and pulls the rug. And maybe that's cheap, but that is the move of so many. Alfred Hitchcock is no less hoary than anybody else in pulling those kinds of cheats.
I'd expect more from Master of Suspense, Brian De Palma.
I don't know why. But yes, this is the only time Michael Caine put on lipstick and whatever. Like, he falls down, and we can clearly see now that it is him for the first time, and Liz's hands are covered in blood like Kate's were in the elevator. Again, you say that early story didn't matter, but I see transference. I see very much that she has been spared the same fate. She was about to go down for the same moralistic reasons, but an innocent child, because she partnered with that child, her life is spared.
Or is it?
Yeah. We get the Psycho, another thing about Psycho, everyone's least favorite scene in the 1960 Alfred Hitchcock movie, is the 20 minutes after we see Norman in the dress. They bring in the doctor to be like, well, let me give you my theories.
Yeah. I had forgotten about this scene in this film. I'm like, oh, please don't go on for 20 minutes. Like, now I get it. You're doing Psycho. Like, please don't make it go on that long. But it's only like five.
It goes on for a while.
Yeah, it's like 5 minutes.
Yeah, they keep it going, and then they intercut it with Peter and Liz at the, as you talked about, the restaurant at the, you know, it's up somewhere high. You can see the New York skyline. It looks like the same place that Rebecca De Mornay and Tom Cruise eat at in Risky Business. It makes me think.
But that's in Chicago.
Oh, you're right. You're right. I was like, were they referencing this movie when they did that? It's a very similar dynamic of like this prostitute that's thinking about going straight with this kid, and this kid that now starting to feel like a man and inviting her back home with him. But Psycho didn't end with, you know, Norman breaking out of the asylum and going after the sister. This is another twist that I think you're right, makes me think a little bit about the Carrie jump scare.
Not just that, but the music. When we see Nancy Allen wake up, the music being played is almost identical to the music played at the end of the dream sequence at the end of Carrie.
Yeah, and that's not I'm uncreative. That is, I want you to think about me. As well as Hitchcock. That is someone that is saying, remember my film, reflecting on both. This is not just someone trying to do what they do with their idols. It's someone, again, I equate it to putting on drag or being two things at once. I am both trying to be Alfred Hitchcock and show you something personal about myself. And maybe I'm a magical creature that synthesizes them both. Or maybe only one thing works for you. Maybe only the thriller works for you. I don't know. This ending would feel cheap. And I remember hating it. When I first watched this movie, I remember thinking, oh, fuck you, a dream sequence? Crap.
I'm just really upset we don't actually get to see Michael Caine in that tight nurse's outfit.
I mean,
it does feel like the dream sequence goes on for too long. Like, looking back, I was like, wait a second.
There's a lot of staring at those nurse's shoes standing in the doorway.
A lot of her showering. Again, more titty shots of the director's wife.
Well, I'm not complaining about that part.
But even before that, was Elliot killing the nurse and breaking out all part of the dream sequence? Or did that really happen?
It's gotta be. The way the rest of the mental patients are all, like, standing there cheering them on, like, that's all gotta be part of the dream.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't make a sequel. So we don't have, this didn't become a slasher franchise. How weird would that be if it did? But it has those vibes. It feels like it's gone from Hitchcock to Friday the 13th, which is, of course, what Psycho is the parent of, all those slasher movies. So
you say, how weird would it be if it became a slasher series? But Psycho did. We reviewed 5 of those.
Sure. Right after this movie, we got a Psycho 2. But my point is, Michael Caine running around in a nurse's outfit feels very different to me than a guy in a hockey mask or a William Shatner mask or even a leather skin mask. Like, that would have been a weird franchise.
But a Norman Bates in a dress?
He didn't do that for 5 movies. You know, like, and they played with that. Was he really insane? Here, again, yeah, you can have a debate about whether this is all her. I mean, what would it mean? To me, it means maybe I'm tempted to go back to be a lady of the night. I'm hanging out with this kid, but tomorrow I'm going to go walk the streets again. And that's going to be death, right? Like, that's the morality of all of that. But I do love the shot. You know, so many cool split screens. But when we see that death of the nurse, and it is another split screen of it's almost like an amphitheater. You know, in the medical schools where they have the students, like, looking down as they perform the operation. These people on that winding staircase, like, looking, the way that they're half the screen and the other half is Michael Caine becoming that nurse, finally living out his dream of transforming. Yeah, it could have ended there. We didn't necessarily need Nancy Allen in the shower, but I guess some people wanted to see that.
A, yes. And B, I also liked the shot of Nancy Allen's throat getting slit there, though. First of all, it shocked the hell out of me. I mean, I was a step ahead of this movie, I felt, for most of the movie. And then she gets her throat slit. I'm like, I did not see a nihilistic end coming.
Because you do see her get her own straight razor. I guess everyone shaved her straight razors, like, in the 70s mm-hmm. or early 80s. But yeah, we get, like, a little straight razor sword fight for a second.
And then the fact that when she gets her throat slit, she's just closing that mirror and you're seeing the reflection of it. I thought it was a nice shot.
No, it definitely is a fool, yeah, because you think she has the upper hand. She sees the shoes. She's getting the razor. Okay, I don't know if she can overpower Michael Caine, but, like, it'll be interesting to watch her try. But no, the way that they do it, yeah, because there's so many mirrors and angles that are happening in those final moments, they're cutting it as rapidly as the shower scene in Psycho. You realize, yeah, all of a sudden she's dead. And that is a shocker. I agree. I jump.
Well, will we be shocked by when I ask, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Dress to Kill? Jacob.
Yeah, I watched this one more as a companion piece to Blowout than as a statement on Hitchcock, but that's maybe because I don't have that schooling or just that much knowledge. But definitely watching this time, yeah, I saw a lot of Hitchcock. Definitely some Psycho, definitely some Rear Window. No Birds, though. But to me, what's interesting about this film is, yeah, it's trashy Hitchcock, maybe, but I feel like that's De Palma, again, as a companion piece to Blowout, he struggles with that. Is it art, or is it just exploitation? Is it voyeurism, or is there something deeper there? And so I think it's interesting on that level. On one hand, yeah, this is a trashy sexploitation film where it's going to go for those gratuitous titty shots, and it's got some tricky identity politics to wrestle with in 2021 and all that, but it goes for it. And on the other hand, it's De Palma just doing all that technical stuff he does so well, split screens and stuff with sound. Like, that is what really draws me to him. Okay, he's copying Hitchcock, whatever. I really like when he gets into those technical aspects. Like, those to me are the strongest moments in any of his films. So This one, yeah, it's a weird exploitation cross-dressing thriller, but there's also other stuff going on, which always makes it more interesting to me. Just this one, yeah, maybe it's a very personal film to De Palma, like you're saying, Stuart, where it's biographical and there's stuff that only he could really understand. But I do feel like it's not as straightforward with its themes, but it gets into a lot of interesting ideas. And so, yeah, you're going to take a trashy slasher and kind of frame it like a giallo and get into some interesting subtext. I'm there for it. Yeah, I could give this a recommend.
Stuart.
Is it a man? Is it a woman? Is it trash? Is it high art? It's postmodernism. Dress to Kill is a shapeshifter that changes depending on the lens you want to look through. And if you go into this movie cold, if you've never looked at a Hitchcock film, and a lot of people haven't at this point, his stuff is, I mean, he died, interestingly enough, he died 3 months before this movie came out. So it really was like a baton to, you know, passing of the torch from one to the other. If you didn't have that reference point, I guess you'd probably just think that this was extravagant. You would think there are a lot of cool shots here. Maybe you respond to it as a thriller, or maybe you laugh at it as this ludicrous plot, or maybe you just get offended because what it's saying about trans people is so offensive and retrograde. But if you look at it as I did when I first saw it through the lens of a film experience, you definitely see that he is restaging very famous moments from Vertigo, Rear Window, particularly Psycho, to continue a conversation that film critics have always had for decades about Hitchcock's themes of voyeurism and objectification. And that may piss you off. You may be tempted. I was to say, plagiarist, you don't get to do that. Like, if you invent something, you patent it, and then that's yours, which is totally not fair and totally not true, and all art is theft. But that was my attitude when I originally saw this movie. Now that I'm looking at it through the lens of De Palma autobiography, now that I've read about what he put into this movie and conversations he's talked about where this inspiration came from, it's a weird sensation of, like, the crazier this movie gets, the more I feel at the same time it's like De Palma pulling back a curtain and saying, I'm going to be confessional. I'm going to be real. I'm going to show you who I am, even as this movie goes away into the ether. And so he kind of undresses as that gets dolled up into something patently absurd, but quite enjoyable. And so, yeah, I'm really surprised. Like, I don't think I get to say anymore I don't like Brian De Palma, because we're 5 for 5 now. Everything we've covered on this show, I like. And I like this movie a lot. I don't have anything bad to say about this movie. I had a really good time watching it. And that was not my memory of 25, 30 years ago when I watched Dress It to Kill.
Do you agree with your professor now?
Yeah, I wish I could have that conversation. I wish I could have understood what he was saying at the time. But yeah, is it sexual hysteria? Is it meta commentary about our moralistic, you know, like, attitudes about sex? Like, it pushes a lot of buttons. I definitely think that people are going to walk away with, it does me. I laugh, I roll my eyes, I gasp, I marvel at the craft and the showmanship. I think it's okay to have complicated feelings about art. I think you can hate things about this movie and love it as well. What I will never do again is say that De Palma was a plagiarist. He is not passing off Psycho as his own work. Whatever he's doing to Hitchcock, to me, it feels like putting on drag. I'm going to call that its own performance. And I'm going to say, high recommend. Go watch it. It's a really cool, unusual performance. And now I'm thinking, like, do I have to go back to Body Double? Because I hated that movie. But maybe I'm all wrong about it. Maybe Phantom of the Paradise is, like, a great film. But I'm thinking about all the other Brian De Palma movies I shat on and thinking, I need to see them again.
As for me, I'm kind of torn. Yes, I definitely see Hitchcock allusions here going on. But to me, this is two different films. One is a highly stylized visual film that is epitomized by the 10-minute museum scene that is really well done and something great to behold. I just really enjoyed the look of this film and the way De Palma used visuals to tell his story. Really just, I dare say, masterful control of the movie format with the split diopter shots with, you know, I've seen a lot of split screen. Never before have I seen split screen with two conversations going on that are separate on each side of the split screen and it working together almost like a medley. Just technically really, really well done. But then you have the thriller part of this movie, and it's pretty good. You know, I like the twist that the person we thought our main character was is killed a third of the way through. I do like Nancy Allen's performance in this movie. I think she is the glue that keeps this movie together.
Wow. Never been said about Nancy Allen.
I know. I'm surprised I'm saying it, but she is a solid performer here. I mean, you can't give it to Keith Gordon. The movie is Nancy Allen's movie. That she's third billed is a bit of a misnomer. I mean, she is this movie for the majority of it. And so it rides a lot on her shoulders and she's able to do it. But I do feel that the mystery, if that's something that interests you, isn't as well disguised as it could be. And I do feel like there are some cheats that piss me off, like that cop coming out of nowhere at the end and attacking Peter for no reason, as in muffling him and pulling him out of the way in the way that it's done, or that cop in the wig. Basically everything with this mysterious other cop that's trailing her to be revealed, the way it's done, and the fact that, yeah, nobody notices, Bobby never went into the apartment. There's just conveniences for the sake of elongating the mystery that frustrate me. So I'm not as high on this film as Stuart is. I think it is really artfully made and a mediocre thriller plot that I can definitely recommend, but not the highest of recommends, not my favorite De Palma film. I still like Blowout a lot better than this. But recommend.
Yeah, I think this is your first time watching. I'll be curious to know if you ever come back to it, if it changes, because that's definitely what I mean, it's a cultivator for me. Like, the taste of it initially is like, what the hell is this? Like a fine wine or a cheap beer, like you don't want it at first. And then maybe you grow to like it. Like, and I feel like this is both. I think it is fine wine and cheap beer together in the same glass.
And I do agree with you, Stuart. The first time I watched this, I was like, okay, whatever. And this time I did get a lot more into it, not just because I'm watching for now playing, but yeah, just I knew what to expect more this time, so I could pick up a lot more of the subtle things that De Palma is doing and appreciate it more.
But Sean, what about you? What do you think about this and what makes you appreciate this film?
Yeah, it's really just the filmmaking that De Palma brings to this. Like, yeah, I think if a lesser director, and I'm not even saying De Palma's one of our greatest directors, but if a lesser director made this, I'd definitely do a Red Arrow and we wouldn't be doing the show tonight. But yeah, I think his style, it doesn't always work. It probably, for the most part, doesn't work. And he's made many, many films, but yeah, I hold this up right beside Blowout, right beside Obsession, Carrie. Like, not as high, but I'm just saying there's a few that I'm like in awe of, you know, just by his camera work and his technical aspects. The story, yeah, it's not the greatest, but you know, I mean, you know, filmmaking's, you know, many things, you know, it's not just acting and storytelling, and I can forgive him for not being the strongest storyteller.
I think that's definitely true of thrillers. Like, they're always kind of ridiculous when you look at the story. It's like, did it thrill you? And I think you're right. Technically, this movie is very thrilling, and I haven't seen Obsession. That's one of the ones that I never went to, but you put that on one of the better works. I'm going to put that one down.
You've seen it if you've seen, you know, a Hitchcock film.
Oh, I know. I know I've seen them all. But I mean, I have been meaning to catch that one. And I'm right about Body Double, right? That's horrible, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, I struggled to go into the, I mean, that's even late 80s. But yeah, in the 90s, just, yeah, after Blowout, really just, or maybe Scarface. Yeah, skip them all until Mission Impossible. And that's not even really his movie.
Right.
Yeah, that does not feel like a De Palma film.
I watched for this review. I couldn't watch all of them, but I did for the first time watch Bonfire of the Vanities, and boy, I can't believe that one was released. Terrible. And Stuart, you mentioned that this felt like Cruising. You know, De Palma really wanted to make that. He even wrote a treatment for that screenplay and couldn't get the rights, so this was like the makeup for him. You know, when De Palma was sound mixing this, he had to insert some fill that for like footsteps. I don't know exactly where it is in the movie, but you know, basically he didn't have room tone for like a footstep scene, and they had to just get, you know, some that was left over from another movie. And he looked at the label and it was Phil from Lawrence of Arabia. And he's like, oh my God, the greatest, like my favorite film of all time is being used as Phil. And that's how he got the inspiration for that climax of Blowout. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but John Travolta uses a sound effect that's, you know, really
important
in a cheap little
interesting
thriller.
Yeah.
I'm sad we're not doing Blowout as a follow-up to this, because I do feel, you're right, they feel like companion films and confessional films and good films. So, and you're right, it was De Palma at the peak of his powers. Later 80s, even if you like some of the films, different. Untouchables is very different than these movies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I could also recommend Noah Baumbach's documentary that he did. It's just, you know, just him interviewing De Palma about his work. I really loved that documentary also.
All right, well, Sean, thank you once again for picking a movie and for joining us on the show. It's been a lot of fun, and yeah, I got a chance to see a movie that's been on my to-watch list for a long time. Finally got to see it.
And patrons, hold on to your hats, because we got a Valentine's Day treat for you next week. Another donor has picked us to cover the four-hour Japanese epic Love Exposure. And whatever you think it's about, it's kind of like Fight Club. It's bigger. It's crazier. It goes in directions you cannot even believe. I will never forget seeing it in the theaters and the audience reaction. I think it's the perfect movie to celebrate the season of love. Next week, February patrons, Love Exposure. Don't miss it.
4 hours, I'm guessing the audience reaction was shifting in their seats, needing to piss?
Nah, well, they took an intermission. They actually allowed us to, like, they stop it halfway through and let people do their thing and process. There's just going to be a lot to process. A lot to talk about next week, but I'll let you guys discover it and we'll join us next Friday.
So, Sean, thank you for your support of our show tremendously. Jacob Stewart, thank you for getting dressed up for the show with me. And now we can get back to the mindfuck.
Look, Liz, I gotta get home and get to work.
I'm gonna miss having you on my tail. Made me feel kind of safe.
Look, you wanna come home with me? I love the company.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Thank you very much for your help. I'll be in touch.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
You know, it's really a great investment.
And a special thanks to Sean Ray for his incredible support of our show and for picking Dressed to Kill for our hosts to review.
I mean, 10 years from now could be worth $1 million. More if the artist dies, of course.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
This is the most incredible thing that I've ever built.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
He gave me one of his wham-bang specials this morning, and I'm mad at him.
Now Playing is edited by Heath and Arnie.
You know, I'm very proud and excited about your project, but I don't want you working all night on it.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
I'd like to see him again. When's he coming back?
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You got a lot better motivation than I do. Your ass.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein. All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
Come with me and, we'll talk to the police.
I've already been to the police.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved. Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2022, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Thank God straight fucks are still in style.
Now I'm thinking, like, do I have to go back to Body Double? Because I hated that movie, but maybe I'm all wrong about it. Maybe Phantom of the Paradise is, like, a great film. But I'm thinking about all the other Brian De Palma movies I shat on and thinking, I need to see them again.
Can we review Bonfire of the Vanities?
Bonfire of the Vanities was a mistake. I would love to cover it, but I don't think that anyone called it, even at the time, it was a strange match of material with director. Brian De Palma wasn't the right guy to tell that story.
who was with that story. But anyway.
Oh, a lot. I mean, it's a wonderful book. I love the book.